to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 8th of August, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty here, and we are gathered here today to discuss the week's news of interest to nationalists, and also to talk about a new one of our greatest Britons in this series. I think we've got about 50 greatest Britons now. I'm actually very proud of having that here at Radio Albion. So we have a new greatest Britons for today, and we have two new subjects to get into. And of course, we have with us today my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day. I'm doing very well indeed. Enjoying the lovely hot weather we've been having this lately. It's only been able, I've been able to get out and enjoy the sun. And yeah, it's lovely. And this is part of the bonus of global warming, the fact that we will start to enjoy periods of continental weather here in the UK. Hopefully the downsides of it won't be too severe. And if we plan properly, then we can avoid the worst of the downsides. But I think one of the things that us British have been ridiculed and criticised for before in the past has been our obsession with the weather and the changeability and wetness of our weather. But all that seems to be changing in some respects for the better, in some other respects not quite for the better.
Well, I hope it does stay that way. I mean, we've had warm periods before in the past, haven't we? Certainly in the Middle Ages and before that. And it would be very nice if we had nice, long, hot summers. Perhaps that would take our mind off what's going on with the economy. We've had terrible news this week that the interest rates are going up. Now, this isn't something that I'm particularly well educated about, but I do know this is one of your specialist subjects, Max. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what's happening with the economy and these interest rates?
Well, inflation at the moment is rising. It's now being predicted to rise to something like about 13% next year. And inflation has the ill effect of eroding people's the purchasing power of people's money. And it particularly affects elderly people that are perhaps retired and have got money on in a building society. And if the inflation rate is raging at 13% and you're only getting something like 1.5% in terms of interest on your money, and obviously your money is being devalued by a rate of something like about 11.5% as each year goes by. And so it's a process by which the majority of people in the country are impoverished. And so that's why it is regarded as being such an evil thing. The Bank of England have put have put their base rate up by 0.5% just within the last week. And this has been done, so the bank tell us, in order to combat inflation. But this is old Conservative Party kind of economics, where they have, in the past, whenever there's been a period of inflation, they've put interest rates up on the basis that by having high interest rates, it's going to reduce inflation. But inflation isn't caused by people initially spending money. Inflation is caused where there is a disproportionate increase in the money supply within an economy compared with the supply of goods and services able to be produced. And in recent weeks, when we've had discussions that have touched upon this in the past, I've mentioned that the current period of high inflation is a direct result of the vast amounts of money that the government borrowed in order to pay furlough, in order to keep the majority of our workforce out of work during the pandemic period, so that they couldn't infect each other. When in reality, what the government should have done is they should have kept the people who had contracted COVID in isolation and allowed the rest of us to carry on working, so that they wouldn't have needed to have borrowed so much money. Because the government have borrowed a load of money, it means that there's a lot more money sloshing around in our economy than there was in the past. And the increase has been disproportionate relative to the increase in goods and services available. In fact, I would imagine perhaps even there hasn't really been an increase in goods and services. And so this is why we've got this inflation. But putting interest rates up is supposed to take money out of the economy. And this is the old Conservative economics, where they say that if you make people pay higher interest rates for all of their loans and for their mortgage, they have less money to spend, and because they've got less money to spend, they won't be able to they won't perpetuate inflation. But the But by putting interest rates up, what happens is that you definitely do take money out of the pockets of the vast majority of ordinary people. But what you do is you just transfer that money into the pockets of the bankers. And our sort of top banking executives will be earning monstrously high bonuses over the course of the next year or so because of the interest rate rises. And of course, they will want to spend their money. And so the money that's been taken out of the economy will just be spent back into the economy again. And so putting interest rates up won't actually affect inflation whatsoever. What's needed to reduce inflation is for the government either to increase the volume of goods and services available to be bought and whilst keeping the supply of money static. And that's going to be a very, very difficult thing to do once you're into a kind of once you're into a recessionary kind of environment, such as is going to be caused by putting interest rates up. But the other thing that the government could do in order to redress the balance between the supply of money in the economy and the value of goods and services available to be bought would be just to take money out of circulation. And this could just be done by through taxation. Instead of talking about having lower taxes, we could just keep taxes as they are. And as taxes are collected in by the Exchequer, a certain amount of the money that's collected in could just be disposed of. And if the money is collected in terms of banknotes, for example, to give you an example of how this could be done, the banknotes could just be taken away and could be burned. And if the government needed didn't have enough money to pay out on the social services and things that they needed, then they could just take less money out of the economy. But taking money out of the economy is the way to is the way to reduce inflation. It could be done by burning banknotes. It could be done by just making ledger entries, as it would have been done in the times gone by when money was accounted for in ledgers. Or it could be done by just subtracting money from the money that's been collected in where it's electronic money. And the vast majority of money in our economy now is electronic money, and so it could be quite easily and simply done coordination with the tax system. So as money is collected in taxes, some of it's just put to one side and effectively eliminated, so that the money being spent by the government and being paid to government workers is reduced. Not that they necessarily need to reduce people's earnings, but so that the overall amount being spent by government is lower than it will have been in the past.
Can I just say something there, Max? Because it seems to me that what they're doing then is they're taxing people through the interest rates, and the money's going to go to the banks instead of taxing people and then taking that tax and using it to pay off the debts which we already have, which I'm assuming would then take that money out of the economy, because that would zero that money. So is that what they're doing? They're basically inadvertently taxing people through the interest rate hikes, which is going to go to the banks, instead of taxing people, which would go to pay off the debt that we already have.
Exactly right. That's exactly the point. Yes, and the point is that it's making the people of average and below average incomes, it's making people in those categories poorer, whilst at the same time making people that are in the richest echelon within our society much richer.
Well, you pointed out there about the products and the services, and how that went down through the COVID lockdown. And the Bank of England are predicting that gross domestic product will fall as much as 2.1%, while the inflation will reach 13% next year in Britain. So what we need to do is get more domestic product created. But in order to do that, you have to have the funds. So, and if you put more funds into the economy, then inflation is going to go up. So would there be a place for something other than funds? I mean, could the government use, I don't know, some value tokens like the Germans did, like the National Socialists did? I mean, didn't they have a similar problem like this? And they generated their own money in order to create projects, vast working projects like building roads. And I mean, is that the equivalent of products and services? Could they do that? Could that be a solution, do you think?
Well, the way that our banking system works is that when a government needs to raise funds, instead of just printing more banknotes or instead of just adjusting the electronic total of money available for them to spend, what they do is they borrow the money from overseas governments or from various banks around the world. And of course, when you borrow money in order to create, to bring it into the economy, you're creating a debt that's then got to be repaid, including interest on top. And so that is not the way really for a government to raise funds. What the government should be able to do is to just create, and as I said before, most money nowadays is electronic money, fiat money, as people might describe it. But if the government was just to create more electronic money so that they can use that to finance the creation of more infrastructure, so that the volume of goods and services within the country can be expanded, and so that new industries can be expanded, then that money borrowed wouldn't necessarily increase the value of the money sloshing around in the economy relative to the goods and services, because by borrowing money in that way, you'd not only increase the volume of money in the economy, you'd also be increasing the volume of the goods and services available to be bought. And so therefore, that balance between money and the volume of money and the volume of goods and services would be maintained. But if you borrow money into the economy, that similarly could be used to invest in infrastructure and things of that sort, but less efficiently, because instead of the money having just been created, the money's been borrowed, so that money's then got to be paid back together with interest. Whereas once the infrastructure project has been completed and the economy has expanded as a result of that, if you've borrowed the money as fiat money, instead of borrowing it from other banks and other foreign governments, then all you need to do is through the taxation system, just take money out of the economy, just cross a few zeros off the end of the total amount of money that the government have got to spend. And in that way, you would then reduce the volume of money available in the economy back down to so that it's you continually maintain the parity. I often liken that the sort of system that needs to be produced is one which operates rather like a fuel injection system. So a fuel injector will have a CPU that will have various sensors within an engine that determines how much fuel is passing through the engine, and on the basis of how much fuel relative to how much air is being sucked into the engine, so that balance is created in order to optimize the power of the engine. And really what needs to be done as far as an economy is concerned is to have a kind of financial fuel injection system where you will have sensors at various points within the economy that sense how much money is being consumed or how much money is required, and that where money is required in order to maintain the balance between goods and services and money, where there is insufficient money, a little bit of extra money is created, and where there is excess money that's likely to drive prices up, a little bit of money is taken out of the economy. And it wouldn't require a genius. Any sort of worthy mathematician could devise such a system, and it would just eliminate inflation completely, and eliminate inflation forever.
Well, of course, they're talking about new systems, aren't they? They're talking about digital credit systems, which would be electronic currency. They're trying to move in on cryptocurrencies, aren't they? China's trying to create their own one. I think America is trying to create their own one, but I think it would be more framed on the system that we already have. But it's quite clear that we've got to a stage where we've just got too much debt, basically because of the interest that's in the system, and they've got to find some way of transferring to a new system. So that, I mean, they are talking about doing similar things like that, but I can't really see the Conservatives changing things. So you think the Conservatives are sort of stuck in a rut and are just repeating what they've done before in the past, in the hopes that that's going to solve the issue, when really it needs completely blue sky thinking on it? Is that sort of what you're saying there, Max?
Well, putting interest rates up in order to combat inflation is just creating a pretext for banks to milk more money out of the economy at the expense of ordinary people, effectively, because it's not necessary to do that. The extra money that's required, or that the extra money that's got to be taken out of the economy, can be taken out of the economy through taxation in the way that we've just described. It would still have an effect in terms of taking money out of people's pockets, but it would, there would be no debt involved, and so therefore it would be a far more efficient way of taking money out of the economy, and it would be taking money out of the economy in such a way that it doesn't reward reward one section of our society whilst penalising the other.
So it's a more nationalist-inspired economy that looks after everyone instead of just looking out for these bankers at the top, then, basically. I mean, that's what we need. We need to be looking at things from the nationalist point of view rather than from the globalist point of view. Well, away from the economy, we've also had some positive things that have been said by our new Attorney General, Suella Braverman. I've talked about her before here at Radio Albion. She's spoke out about schools changing the gender of children, saying that this should not be going on. You cannot legally change your name or your gender until you're over 18. So schools should not be doing this. This comes on top of Kemi Badenoch saying that schools should not be teaching white privilege and white guilt. And both of them, I think, are supporting Liz Truss. And this Suella Braverman, I mean, she did stand for the leadership, but she got knocked out, I think, in the first round. She's come out with an article last week condemning the diversity agenda, which is particularly interesting. I'll quote from this article here. She says, "It is all too easy to view the past through the prism of the present and then use the new orthodoxy to settle old scores. Today, that orthodoxy is called diversity, equality, and inclusion." I think they've actually even changed that to equity instead of equality. "The new DEI sector came about as a byproduct of the rights culture created by a combination of New Labour's Human Rights Act and the Equality Act. The plight of women like Maya Forstarter, who lost her job after tweeting that transgender women could not change their biological sex, are all a part of this long tale of Blairism. Her legal fight ultimately ended in a triumph for common sense and freedom of speech. But how did we get to a point where stating the facts of biology could get you sacked? Whenever ministers point out these problems, people quite rightly ask, what are you doing about it? And so, as the Attorney General, I ordered my officials to brief me on the diversity training going on in the government legal department. I was horrified to discover that hundreds of government lawyers spent nearly 2,000 hours of their taxpayer-funded time last year attending lectures on micro-incivilities, different lived experiences, and how to be a straight ally, courtesy of the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender rights charity, Stonewall. The experts on white privilege, who shared their insights, were cited as authoritative, but they all subscribed to the left-wing view on race, gender and sexuality, which permeated their training materials. I would encourage other ministers to ask to see their departments' diversity programs and scrutinise the value for money they offer. After all, the diversity agenda thrives in darkness. Government lawyers are being told that if a black person says something is offensive, then it is offensive, and they do not have a right to question it. How does that fit in with the rule of law or due process? This kind of thinking is harmful in other departments, but in legal cases, it is downright dangerous. It does nothing to create solidarity and encourage support, but rather keeps emphasizing differences, creates a sense of otherness, and pits different groups against each other. Well, I've told my officials to scrap it. We really must get serious about taking on this divisive mindset and call it out for what it is, a new religion with a new priestly caste. Some zealots believe in it, like the witch finders of the Middle Ages. They don the outfit of the Inquisitor and never tire of rooting out unbelievers. Others wear the priestly robes to ward off their rivals, while still others nod along and recite the creed because they are too scared to dissent. None of these approaches are acceptable in modern Britain. I'm all for building an inclusive workplace which is meritocratic and welcoming, but to focus relentlessly on dividing us into different cohorts rather than on building camaraderie based on unifying values is misguided. This is something Liz Truss has been very good on. She told the Tory conference that we reject the zero-sum game of identity politics, we reject the illiberalism of cancel culture, and we reject the soft bigotry of low expectations. That's the kind of Conservative Party I want to be a member of. It's the kind of Britain that I believe in. In government, I've seen her working hard to fight this pernicious identity politics, which is stifling our potential just as surely as the high tax burden. And I am especially glad she is committed to scrapping diversity jobs all across Whitehall. Britain needs a lot of things, but it certainly doesn't need woke commissars policing our thoughts. We need to worry less about what people say on Twitter and more about ensuring passports arrive on time, GP appointments are available when needed, and the police turn up when you've been burgled. Diversity jobs may have been created with good intentions, but it is clear they are now a part of the problem and not the solution. And Suella Braverman has been the Attorney General for England and Wales since 2020. Her religion is Buddhist. I think she's originally from India, but she's certainly talking a lot of sense there. And I go along with what she's saying. I mean, the one bit I wouldn't go along with is she doesn't like this idea of separating us into cohorts and says we should have unifying values, and obviously being a nationalist, I think that we should have our political state should be organized on ethnic grounds rather than unified values. I think blood is thicker than water. But the fact that she is saying that this diversity agenda is basically saying that black people can say whatever they like and we have to go along with it, and that's creeping its way into law. The fact that this diversity agenda is in all these government departments, it needs to be removed. They're wasting thousands of hours on learning how to be a white ally and all these left-wing ideas. And the fact that all of this diversity stuff is being presented from a left-wing point of view, of course, where anti-racism just means anti-white, because, of course, there are other ways to be anti-racist. I would suggest that the best way to get rid of racism is just to have ethnically homogenous communities. You couldn't have any racism then. It would be impossible to feel that you had been discriminated against, because the people that you were living amongst would all be exactly the same as you. And that would eliminate racism straight away. And that's the, I guess, the hard right way to be anti-racist, and the left-wing way to be anti-racist is just simply to be anti-white and to blame white people for all the differences that we see in outcomes between the different ethnic groups. So it's very good to see Suella Braverman talking about this. And we've also had the new chief of Greater Manchester Police. He's spoken out about the police wasting their time on Twitter debates, and he's spoken before about how his police force won't be wearing rainbow shoelaces and showing support for left-wing political ideas, that and the public want to see the police investigating burglaries, not Twitter. And this also comes on top of the Police Federation issuing new guidance to the police, saying that it's not good enough for somebody just to say, oh, I was offended at what somebody said. The police have to prove that there was a hostile intent behind what somebody is saying. So to simply say that biological women are women and they cannot change into biological men, that's not said with hostility. That's just basic reality. And that's the same thing that this Suella Braverman is saying here. And she's questioning, how is it that we got to this state where this is creeping its way into law? Well, it's gradually made its way there, hasn't it? Through case law, through these zealous left-wing lawyers. They talk about the zealous diversity commissars, but you also have that in the legal profession. And we also have these organizations like Hope Not Hate that are relied upon by the government, but are extreme left-wing fanatics that are going after anybody just right of center, basically. And this is the Conservative Party. They're supposed to be putting a stop to this. So it's very good to see Suella Braverman speaking out about this. What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on this. It's interesting that it's Suella Braverman, you know, who said all this, and not one of the other candidates. To throw a pun into the works, she's obviously a braver man than the two contestants that are contesting the leadership of the Conservative Party, because one of them ought to have said something like this a long time ago. And people who've been in leadership positions within the Conservative Party should have said something like this a long time ago. There is this sort of constant beating of the drum for diversity and the beating of the drum to drive out of society the phrase, there is no place for people who think this in our society. They're not the words of somebody who's truly trying to create diversity, because if you wanted diversity, you would also like to have diversity of opinion and diversity of beliefs. But in fact, the people who beat the drum for diversity, they don't actually want that. They want only people who believe what they believe to be able to speak in society. And this exposes the hypocrisy of what they claim, and that the people who aim to promote diversity, they've got to a point now where companies that are advertising their products on television are terrified of having predominantly white people in their adverts, despite the fact that the majority of the population of this country is still white. Something like 85% of the population of Britain is still white, and it's a guiding principle of marketing that you aim your marketing material at your target audience, and the target audience which is the largest, so that you have the highest level of impact. And if having black people or brown people or non-white people in adverts encourages non-white people to buy that product, then by the same token, not having white people in those adverts should have the effect of deterring white people from wanting to buy those things. By the same logic, I'm not necessarily suggesting that logic is correct, but by the same logic, that would be the case. And the fact is that people who complain about the lack of diversity aren't currently complaining about the lack of diversity in the individuals chosen to be the main characters in all sorts of television adverts, advertising all sorts of products, where the companies that pay for those products and pay for those adverts to advertise their products have caved in and have now accepted that diversity means having lots more non-white people in your adverts rather than the number of white people that ordinarily would have been in those adverts had this sort of drumbeat for diversity not been taken up. And we have a situation where if a white person blacks their face up to play a black actor, or it features in a film or any kind of production where they play the part of somebody who would have been black historically, there's all this cry of blackface and how the identity of black people is being masked and cast aside and denigrated, when in fact the opposite doesn't. These same people that are beating the drum for diversity don't complain when the opposite happens, and when there are non-white people chosen to play the parts individuals in films and TV programs where the person that they're playing was obviously a white person, the whole diversity industry is built on hypocrisy. And this is why we as nationalists say that diversity just really means anti-white, because only where diversity increases the number of non-white people, only where diversity increases the influence of non-white people and the wealth of non-white people, that's the only time when diversity is valued by these diversity fanatics. Where diversity fair shares for everybody should carry the day, then these diversity warriors are absolutely silent, because and that betrays the fact that these diversity warriors really are aiming to reduce the wealth, to reduce the influence, to reduce the numbers of white people in our society, and it is all part of a kind of genocidal agenda.
It just shows they can't succeed in a meritocratic society. They have to have all these diversity quotas and all these programs to increase diversity, because without that they don't succeed in a meritocratic society. As Suella Braverman is saying there, that's what she wants to see, is a meritocratic society. But what we see instead of that, as you're pointing out there, Max, is this promotion of diversity at the expense of everything else, even with these advertising companies, at the expense of making money. They will promote diversity because they're terrified of what she calls here the witch finders, that are constantly looking out for micro incivilities or microaggressions or anything which they can construe as being based upon race at all. Then they will condemn it, and they will condemn it as heresy, and the company will lose money, or if it's an individual, they can be debanked, they can lose their social media, and everybody's terrified of this. And she's saying, well, how can this have got so bad? How come this has got so far? Well, she's part of the party that should have been putting a stop to it. You know, the Conservative Party have been in power for 10, 15 years, and it's just continued relentlessly, this promotion of diversity. And she's correct, I think, to identify it as beginning with Tony Blair, and with the Human Rights Act, and with the Equality Act. So, and since she's the Attorney General, perhaps they might do something about it. They are talking about creating a new Bill of Rights, aren't they? But of course, I don't think people are too hopeful, because don't forget, this is the same Conservative Party that is bringing in the Online Harms Bill, which contains this sinister phrase, legal but harmful, which means entirely legal speech that the Conservative Party decide people shouldn't be able to hear. They don't want people to hear it. So they ask the social media companies to take it down. If the social media companies don't take it down, they get massive fines. And the people that get to determine what this kind of speech is, because remember, it's completely legal speech. But if the government decide they don't like it, then legal but harmful speech. So it's a complete encroachment on freedom of speech. So what is Suella Braverman going to do about it? I'm very pleased she's speaking about these issues, but now let's see her do more than just remove it from her department. Let's see her get it removed from all of these departments in Whitehall, and let's see some changes in the law to reinforce the freedom of speech that we have here, instead of constantly chipping away at it. Anything else you want to add to that, Max?
Well, just really, the Online Harms Bill is effectively just a continuation of the there is no place in our society for people who think differently from us. There is no place in our society for people who think that a woman can't have a penis. There is no place in our society for people who think that that race is a significant factor in human affairs. There is no place in our society for people who believe anything other than what we believe in. And these are the people. And so whenever I'm talking, addressing our listeners here, whenever our listeners hear somebody say there is no place in our society, then you know that you're listening to one of the people who is one of these diversity warriors, who effectively is just wanting to attack white people in any way they can, and who is all constantly looking for every possible avenue by which they can promote the interests of non-whites relative to the interests of white people, and who are just attempting to whitewash us out of the history books, and to whitewash us off the planet effectively.
They're intolerant bigots. They talk about building a tolerant and inclusive society, but if you don't agree with them, then you're completely excluded, and they are completely intolerant of your views. I mean, Britain did used to be a very, very tolerant society. We used to be known for having lots of eccentrics and lots of different views. And we were told that people might have different opinions to you, and you just have to accept that. That's part of being British. And we've gone to the complete opposite end of the scale, where if you have a different opinion, then you will not be tolerated within society. So let's hope that Suella Braverman continues on this path that she's on. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, our Greatest Briton this week is the wonderful, famous archaeologist, Sir Flinders Petrie, most famously known for his Egyptian archaeology and his Palestinian archaeology. So William Matthew Flinders Petrie, born 3rd of June 1853, died 28th of July 1942. Commonly known as simply Flinders Petrie, was a British Egyptologist and a pioneer of systematic methodology in archaeology and the preservation of artifacts. He held the first chair of Egyptology in the United Kingdom and excavated many of the most important archaeological sites in Egypt, in conjunction with his wife, Hilda Erlin. Some consider his most famous discovery to be that of the Merneptah Stelae, an opinion with which Petrie himself concurred. Petrie developed the system of dating layers based on pottery and ceramic findings. He remains controversial, though, today, for his anti-democratic and pro-eugenics views. He was also a dedicated believer in the superiority of the northern peoples over what were called the Latinate and southern peoples. So this was one of the first Egyptologists to say, well, the original people that came into Egypt and built the civilization in Egypt, they were white. He was the first archaeologist to say, well, we should be looking at the layers that we're digging down into and collecting pottery that and ceramics that look similar. And if they all look similar, then they must be from that same time. And he also educated the archaeologist, or taught the archaeologist, momentarily forget his name, that found Tutankhamun's tomb. I mean, he really did have a huge influence on archaeology, and he was incredibly intelligent as well. He was another of these polymaths, and he was around at the same time as Sir Francis Galton, who had a very high opinion of him. He was one of the most famous British people around at the time. I think partially Indiana Jones was based on Sir Flinders Petrie, and he was just a wonderful character. And I can't stress how important it is that these archaeologists that we had about 150 years ago at the height of the British Empire, because they were digging around in these places like Egypt and India and Palestine, and finding evidence that the people that lived there thousands of years ago, they were all white people. They were all white, and they were preserving these artifacts, because in a lot of these places they were just being destroyed by the people that were living there, because they had no knowledge or no understanding of the value of these things, particularly in Egypt, what was going on there, and particularly in Greece with the marbles there that were being damaged. So we would collect these artifacts, and we would put them in the British Museum where they were safe, where they were no longer at risk of being damaged by the people in the countries they were in, or at risk of being sold to people, private investors, or being melted down. And of course, today we get accused of, this was just racist. We were stealing these things from these people, but they didn't belong to those people in the first place. They were created by white people. There may be non-white people that live in places like Egypt now, but of course, with migrations that occur over time, that's why you have non-white people there. There's been white people there, there's been non-white people there. The fact of the matter is that people groups tend to migrate, the same as we see today with non-whites making their way into Europe. And it was the same back then. There was migration, and a lot of these things were, or well, the majority of these artifacts were created by white people, and obviously we are the descendants of those white people. When they look at the DNA in Egypt, they discovered that, or Tutankhamun's DNA, they discovered that it was closest to Northern Europeans. It didn't have any similarity to the Arabs that are there now. So I would say that these findings are rightfully ours, that they are heirlooms, even though these countries may now have non-whites in them. And as we'll see as we go through this, we'll find out about the other names of archaeologists at the time, and that they're all white people. You know, the Arabs and the Indians, that they weren't interested in digging around in these old ruins to see what was there, because it wasn't a part of their history. Any views on that, Max? You want to comment on that introduction?
Well, I think the behaviour of ISIS in Syria rather demonstrates the attitude that a lot of particularly the Muslim peoples that lived in the Middle East had towards historical artifacts and ruins, and the way in which they destroyed ruins, and the fact that there's been criticism of preserving statues and carvings that depict human forms and that depict animals. Again, is something that is frowned upon in the Muslim world. And so, you know, that is an underlying reason why a lot of these ancient relics and things were not being properly looked after, because they weren't, it wasn't a matter that they weren't valued. It was a matter in some cases that they were viewed as being what's the word I'm thinking of here?
Idolatrous. Pardon? Idolatry.
Yes, idolatrous. That's right. Yes. So it was viewed as being idolatrous. And so therefore, a lot of these things were deliberately destroyed. And, you know, one of the things that very often damages the state of statues and things in a large part of the Middle East is, you know, where people's noses have been snapped off, or their fingers have been snapped off, or, you know, other bodily appendages have been snapped off, which have just been done in some cases deliberately by people who disapproved of the human form being reproduced in stone, and who just wanted to cock a snook at the people who had built these fabulous civilizations in the past.
Of course, now the Egyptians understand the value of the pyramids. I mean, it's a huge tourist draw, isn't it? I mean, recently they had a big movement of one of the mummies going to this great new museum that they set up in Cairo, and they had a huge, great procession and fireworks and music and all sorts. And now they appreciate the value of it. They're not so keen to smash it up and destroy it. But if it wasn't for the British and European archaeologists saying, hey, hang on a minute, this is, you know, this is really important stuff. This tells the history of humanity here that you have here. This is thousands of years old. If it wasn't for that, then we wouldn't have any of it. And Sir Flinders Petrie was one of the most famous and one of the most influential. Well, Petrie was born on the 3rd of June, 1853, in Charlton, Kent, England, the son of William Petrie and Anne, née Flinders. Anne was the daughter of the British captain Matthew Flinders, who led the first circumnavigation of Australia and is whom Matthew was named after. And William Petrie was an electrical engineer who developed carbon arc lighting and later developed chemical processes for Johnson, Matthey and Company. So both his parents came from very good stock. His mother came from stock that was the first to circumnavigate Australia, and his father developed carbon arc lighting, and he was incredibly intelligent. I mean, as we'll also hear later on, his son was famous for inventing something as well. So we can see that you inherit your IQ and you inherit your abilities from your ancestors. And also, I guess at this time, 1853, there still would have been some evolutionary selective pressure. You would have still had people dying in childhood if they were genetically weak. So that explains why there were so many people around that were polymaths and were high intelligence. You want to add anything to that, Max?
No, I agree with what you're just saying entirely. Yes.
Well, Petrie was raised in a Christian household, his father being a member of the Plymouth Brethren, and he was educated at home. He had no formal education. His father taught his son how to survey accurately, laying the foundation for his archaeological career. At the age of 8, he was tutored in French, Latin and Greek until he had a collapse and was then taught at home. He also ventured his first archaeological opinion at the age of 8 years old, when friends visiting the Petrie family were describing the unearthing of the Brading Roman villa in the Isle of Wight. The boy was horrified to hear of the rough shovelling out of the contents, and protested that the earth should be pared away inch by inch to see all that was in it and how it lay. All that I've done since, he wrote when he was in his late 70s, was there to begin with. So true it is that we can only develop what is born within the mind. I was already into archaeology by nature. Very interesting there. So his interest in this went right back to childhood, and straight away he could see that what was going on there in this unearthing of the Roman villa was liable to damage what it was that they were digging up. And this was a big problem with these early archaeologists. They would just dig around, and a lot of them were just treasure hunters. Whereas the way that Petrie was looking at it is, what can we find out about history from this? And it's also very important that the person that does the archaeology, it has a very good imagination, because you've got to imagine from the things that you find how life was back then, and you've got to be very good at it. So you're not just got to be good at recognizing the similarities between the ceramics and what have you, but you've also got to be very good at imagining how society would be, and what these things that you find, what these objects that you find, what it was that they would have been used for. I also find it interesting that he had no formal education at all, and yet he was incredibly intelligent. So his father taught him how to survey, so that I guess that was something that his father was into as well, and then he had this this tutoring as well. But interestingly, he had no formal education to bring this out.
I think that he probably would have realized fairly early on that the tiled flooring in the Roman villas would have had all sorts of designs and patterns within it, many of which would have been symbolic, and all that symbolism would have been lost if you just shoveled up all these tiles and stuck them in a bucket, for example. And so that was a very intelligent observation from him as a boy. It's interesting that his father taught him how to survey, and so this is the use of things like dumpy levels and theodolites in order to calculate and measure the distances between various things and the shapes of various things. And so that tutelage in surveying would have taught him trigonometry and lots of other sort of mathematics as well, which would have been highly beneficial in developing his mind.
Yeah, I think he was the first to properly measure the Great Pyramid, and he produced the most accurate measurements of Stonehenge. So he was very good at this surveying, very good at measuring, and also at digging around, carefully digging around and working out the time period of whatever it was that he was looking into. Well, the chair of Edwards Professor of Egyptian Archaeology and Philology at University College London was set up and funded in 1892 following a bequest from Amelia Edwards, who died suddenly in that year. Now, she had been Petrie's supporter since 1880, and Edwards had instructed that he should be its first incumbent. So this was at a time where you had to have a philanthropist behind you. You had to have someone with considerable finance that was funding this. It wasn't the British government that was funding people to go digging around. It was philanthropists, basically. And he, thankfully, he had this woman that had seen that he had this potential within him. And she funded his expeditions and set up this professorship which he was the first to chair. Now, he continued to excavate in Egypt after taking up the professorship, training many of the best archaeologists of the day. In 1904, Petrie published Methods and Aims in Archaeology, which is the definitive work of his time, in which he lucidly defined the goals and methodology of his profession, along with the more practical aspects of archaeology, such as details of excavation, including the use of cameras in the field, which must have been a fairly new technology at the time. With uncommon insight, he noted that research results were dependent on the personality of the archaeologist, who, in addition to possessing broad knowledge, had to have insatiable curiosity, and his own abundance of that characteristic was never questioned. So that's interesting as well. These research results are dependent upon the personality of the archaeologist. So I guess they would be looking out for things that they, in particular themselves, found interesting. And you don't often think about that, but the character and the personality of the person that's in charge of the dig or in charge of the whole thing, that's going to have a stamp on things, isn't it? Because whatever it is they're most interested in, they're going to find something to do with that in the results. I guess you could say that because he was brought up by the Plymouth Brethren, he had this Christian upbringing. So when he was doing his digging around in Palestine, he was looking for things to do with the Bible, and he obviously had a knowledge of the Bible. So when he found that Meneptah Stela, straight away he spotted that it was talking about Israel. If it had been another archaeologist that hadn't had that upbringing, perhaps they may not have even recognized it. So that's where the personality or the character of the archaeologist comes into play here. Do you want to add
the capacity
anything?
To be meticulous in your methodology, I would think, is one of the things that he had in mind there, because a lot of you sometimes see TV footage of people working on archaeological sites, and such would be the sort of eagerness with which you might want to unearth something. That if you, for example, if you are unearthing a grave, for example, you might discover part of a human skeleton, and you're in your impatience to see the full skeleton, you might hurry and disturb the soil in which the rest of the skeleton lies and damage the skeleton, etc. And so having a sort of patient and meticulous methodology is the way to gain the information, the data that you need to fully analyze the site you've just unearthed.
Yeah, I mean, it must have really sort of grown gradually over time, this idea of archaeology, from Stukeley's time, from just measuring the outside of these things to then digging around into them and carefully working out that, you get excited looking at the skeleton, as you just said there, Max, but then around the skeleton, there might be the remains of clothing, or there might be the remains of jewellery, an indentation in the soil of something that is rotted away. So you might want to take a cast first of all. You can see the way that this has developed over time into a science. And as it says here, he published this definitive book, Methods and Aims in Archaeology, which explained all of this. In 1913, Petrie sold his large collection of Egyptian antiquities to University College London, where it is now housed in the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology. And one of his trainees, Howard Carter, that's the name I couldn't remember earlier, went on to discover the tomb of Tutankhamun in 1922. So he trained a lot of these other archaeologists that have become famous since then. As I said earlier, he was a contemporary of Sir Francis Galton, and this is what he had to say on Petrie's mental capacity. Mr. Flinders Petrie, a contributor of interesting experiments on kindred subjects to nature, informs me that he habitually works out sums by aid of an imaginary sliding rule, which he sets in the desired way and reads off mentally. He does not usually visualize the whole rule, but only that part of it with which he is at the moment concerned. I think this is one of the most striking cases of accurate visualizing power that it is possible to imagine. And that was Sir Francis Galton writing in 1883. And that's quite incredible. I mean, when you think of a sliding rule,
yes,
all the different numbers on it, all the different permutations of it, to actually remember all of that and just accurately visualize a small part of it and be able to come out with the answer to a sum. I mean, this is like the equivalent of being able to use a calculator back in 1883. Quite incredible. In his teenage years, Petrie surveyed British prehistoric monuments, commencing with the late Romano-British camp that lay within yards of his family home in Charlton, in attempts to understand their geometry. And at 19, he produced the most accurate survey of Stonehenge ever, being measured to the nearest 1/10 of an inch. So that's confirming what you were saying there earlier, Max, about geometry and trigonometry. So he would practice at home. I mean, he must have known that this is what he wanted to do from a very, very yes. early age. To be doing this. His father had corresponded with Piazzi Smythe about his theories on the Great Pyramid, and Petrie travelled to Egypt in early 1880 to make an accurate survey of Giza, making him the first to properly investigate how the pyramids there were constructed. Many theories had been advanced upon this, and Petrie read them all, but none of them was based on first-hand observation or logic. So that's quite fascinating. There have been all these books written about the Great Pyramids of Giza, but none of them had actually been written from first-hand observation of them. Petrie's published reports of this triangulation survey and his analysis of the architecture of Giza therein was exemplary in its methodology and accuracy, disproving Smythe's theories and still providing much of the basic data regarding the pyramid plateau to this day. On that visit, he was appalled by the rate of destruction of the monuments. Some, listed in guidebooks, had been worn away completely since then, and also the destruction of the mummies. He described Egypt as a house on fire, so rapid was the destruction, and felt his duty to be that of a salvage man, to get all I could as quickly as possible, and then when I was 60, I would sit down and write it all up. So he knew that what he was having to do was pretty speedy. He had to preserve all this stuff before it was destroyed. So this, again, this confirms what you were saying, Max, about this destruction of these monuments by these by these Arabs there. And the Great Pyramid itself, I mean, the mathematics that is encoded into the Great Pyramid is just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you've got the distance to the sun there. You've got pi, the mathematics of pi. You've got the royal cubit that they used there. And I think Stonehenge was built to the same unit of measurement. We actually did a couple of patriotic history episodes on the Great Pyramid, just because it's just impossible, the amount of mathematics that is encoded into the measurements of the Great Pyramid. It's just mind-boggling to think, how did they know all of this 5,000 years ago when they built this Great Pyramid? Where did they get all this mathematics from? It must have been deliberately done. And that's what it's talking about here with this Piazzi Smythe, because there was lots of interest in the Great Pyramid in the 1800s. And I
also
guess
the surface stones of the pyramids all had to be chiseled out to an exact size and shape so that they would fit together almost like the pieces of a jigsaw, so that it would create the correct level of slope for the pyramids, and so that the stones would weight-wise fall in towards the center of the pyramid, and so therefore be resistant to becoming dislodged. You know, all these sort of things were taken into account by the other people who built the pyramids, and Flanders Petrie was the person who discovered all of this.
Yeah, he was the guy that was the first to make a proper survey of it. I mean, it had the four socket joints in each of the corners. I mean, that's all been specially made, as you were saying there, Max, so that it would withstand the test of time. You think it's been stood there for 5,000 years. And originally there was, I think it was limestone. There was a limestone covering, thin sheets of limestone that was actually glued to the outside of it, which was white. So it would obviously reflect the sun, and it could be seen for hundreds of miles around. This pyramid would just be like glowing white. And that's all been taken away now. And similar to what went on with the monuments in Britain, where people would break them up and use them for building materials, the same thing was going on with these pyramids and these ancient cities in Egypt. They were being smashed up and used for building materials. They just had no knowledge of the value of what it was that they had there. And again, this is proof of the validity of his theories when he was saying that it was white people that built this. And it's just unfeasible that if it had been built by the Arabs, that they wouldn't have actually still had some respect for it. And they had no respect for it. They were just pulling it all down and reusing it. I mean, I know I say we did the same here, really, I guess, with the monuments here, but the ones that we had here didn't have pictures on them, weren't great statues. They were rather more rugged. To think that these Arabs and over there in Egypt were just destroying all of this until the British archaeologists went there to preserve it. And then today we get accused of stealing this stuff when it was of no value to the people that were actually there. I mean, there's one bit here where he found a pavement, or I guess it must have been like a mosaic, and he was the one that put a cover over it. And it's not even there today. And we only have we only know about it because he drew a very careful picture of this mosaic and this pavement. And since then, it's been destroyed. I mean, as it says here, there are all these monuments that used to be in the guidebooks, and they're just not there anymore.
But also the preservation of lots of the mummies, because when the grave robbers used to break their way into pyramids and the tombs and things that they found in Egypt and the Far East, very often the mummified bodies and things would just be dragged out and they would just be scattered and dogs would grab bones and run off with them or whatever, and so we would have no knowledge in many cases as to the type of people who built those civilizations. And it's only through mummied remains being preserved by people like Flinders Petrie that the that we're able to know that through genetic analysis now that the ruling elite within Egypt, as with most of the other Middle Eastern empires, were of European descent.
Yeah, you can see their ginger hair, their blonde hair, their Caucasian features. I mean, you can see just from the shape of the bodies themselves that they're Caucasian. And on some of them, they've done DNA tests and shown that they're European. But I think they haven't done any more tests on it because they were showing they were European rather than showing that they were Arabs. Returning to England at the end of 1880, Petrie wrote a number of articles and then met up with Amelia Edwards, the journalist and patron of the Egypt Exploration Fund, now the Egypt Exploration Society, who became his strong supporter and later appointed him as professor at her Egyptology chair at University College London. Impressed by his scientific approach, the university offered him work as the successor to Edouard Neville. Petrie accepted the position and was given the sum of £250 per month to cover the excavation expenses. And in November 1884, Petrie arrived in Egypt to begin his excavations. And he first went to a new kingdom site at Tanis with 170 workmen. And Tanis is in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He cut out the middleman role of the foreman on this and all subsequent excavations, taking complete overall control himself and removing the pressure on the workmen from the foreman to discover finds quickly but sloppily. Although he was regarded as an amateur and a dilettante by more established Egyptologists, this made him popular with his workers, who found several small but significant finds that would have been lost under the old system. So again, this is what you were pointing to earlier, Max, about them rushing through this, trying to find things. So there was this pressure on the Arab workmen to find things. So they would just rush through everything, trying to find something that the British guy would be interested in, because they, you know, they wouldn't really know what it was that the British were looking for. They would probably mainly be looking for treasure. Whereas the, somebody like Flinders Petrie would have been looking for, what was written down on the stele. So a piece of stone with writing on it may have been far more of value to him than something that had been made of gold. And of course it was when he found this Merneptah stele. Any comments on that, Max?
Well, just to sort of agree with you again, I was just thinking about other aspects of archaeology and perhaps like earlier human forms, etc., where for example the original Neanderthal skull that was found in Germany, you know, that that skull or partial skull was found at a time prior to the sort of meticulous approach advocated by Flinders Petrie had been taken up. And so there are a lot of very ancient skulls and things that have been found where it's now impossible to carry out genetic analysis of them by virtue of the fact that they've been handled by so many people, and so much sweat from the hands of people that have handled them has become absorbed into the surface of the bone, etc., that that there is now so much modern DNA mixed in with the original Neanderthal DNA that it's very difficult to actually determine anything significant from the bones. And that there's other other similar skulls that have been found very early on in the during the time that archaeology developed, and there was a skull in Rhodesia that I can't remember it's been named as Homo rhodesiensis, but this is a skull that again was found at a time prior to the sort of meticulous approach advocated by Flinders Petrie, and again so many people have handled it that it's been dated. It was originally carbon dated with carbon 14, then it's been dated with other successive forms of dating, and the estimate of the age of that particular skull has varied from 25,000 years old all the way through to about 250,000 years old. So, you know, such is the wide gulf of dating of it, and just purely as a result of the DNA having become contaminated through handling by various people.
You just wouldn't think of things like that, would you? They would need to wear gloves so it wouldn't become contaminated, and just your sweat could damage things. I mean, so some of the hardest things to find is the clothing. I mean, we're very lucky to find the mummies that were preserved in China, for instance. I forget the name of the exact part of the world, the Tarim Plateau. And they found mummies there, Caucasian mummies from, I think, 2000 BC, and where there were salt flats there that had actually preserved the clothing. So you could see that they had clothing similar to the clothes that we wear today. They had felt hats, and they had trousers. They had a plaid that they actually had. They had a very similar warp and woof to what we actually have today. And that's the sort of thing that is normally rotted away before you actually find it. But they found that in these salt flats. So you know, a lot of these things now we can look at the imprint of what's left there before they pull the body up, and they can sort of tell what the clothing was then. But as you say, before the time of Petrie and systematizing all of this and working out the very best way of doing it, it was just in a great rush to try and find treasure. In 1880,
it's a forensic approach that's required. Yeah. That's the word that I was struggling for earlier on. A forensic approach is required in order to do this sort of thing properly.
That's the one. In 1886, while working for the Egypt Exploration Fund, Petrie excavated at Tel Nebeshe in the eastern Nile Delta. This site is located 8 miles southeast of Tanis, and among the remains of an ancient temple there, Petrie found a royal sphinx, which is now located at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. By the end of the Tanis dig, he ran out of funding, but reluctant to leave the country in case it was renewed, he spent 1887 cruising the Nile, taking photographs as a less subjective record than sketches. During this time, he also climbed rope ladders at Sehel Island near Aswan to draw and photograph thousands of early Egyptian inscriptions on a cliff face, recording embassies to Nubia, famines, and wars. So once he's run out of funding for the digging, he's still drawing and photographing everything that he could so that he could record it for future generations, knowing that these things were likely to get damaged by that time. And by the time he reached Aswan, a telegram had reached there to confirm the renewal of his funding, and he then went straight to the burial site at Fayum, particularly interested in post-30 BC burials, which had not previously been fully studied. He found intact tombs and 60 of the famous portraits, and discovered from inscriptions on the mummies that they were kept with their living families for generations before burial. Under Auguste Mariette's arrangements, he sent 50% of these portraits to the Egyptian Department of Antiquities. However, when he later found that Gaston Maspero had placed little value on them and left them open to the elements in a yard behind the museum to deteriorate, he angrily demanded that they all be returned, forcing Maspero to pick the 12 best examples for the museum to keep and to return 48 to Petrie, who sent them to London for a special showing at the British Museum. And resuming work, he discovered the village of the Pharaonic tomb workers. So he's even facing problems in his day of actually keeping these things from rotting apart and falling apart. It's saying there that they gave it, he gave them to the Egyptian Department of Antiquities. I'm not sure whether that means actually in Egypt, and then the Egyptians just left them in a yard to rot, or whether that was an Egyptian Department of Antiquities somewhere else. But it does just show that even then they weren't paying the attention to these things that they should have done. They were still looking out for things that were made of gold or
I would assume treasure. That it was an Egyptian Department of Antiquities rather than a Department of Egyptian Antiquities. So I would think it was a museum in Egypt that had where this Gaston Maspero officiated.
Well, again, and it shows you that this is why we took these things, so that they were looked after, because they weren't going to be looked after in places like Egypt. They weren't going to be looked after in places like Greece. I mean, I hear recently that they're talking about giving the marbles back to Greece. I mean, is that such a good idea? I mean, all of these things are centred in the London Museum, and people from all around the world can travel to London to see these things. If you start handing them back to the places that you took them from, they're not all going to be collected in the same area. And it's really disrespectful to the people that dug them up, like Petrie, to then go handing them back to the people that he took them from in order to preserve them. And of course, he would have paid for them as well. I mean, the Egyptians would have been paid well for this. I mean, all these workers and that were doing the digging for him, they were paid well. It's not like the country didn't actually benefit from this. And the same.
You mentioned, I think it was £250 a month that he was given to finance his digging. £250 a month in those days would have been a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah, and the people that were working for him, they liked him as well, because he didn't hurry them up. He wanted them to take their time and find anything of value to bring them to him. And as we'll find out later on, this Meneptah stela was the thing of greatest value, and that wasn't because of what was written on the front of it. It was because of what was written on the back of it. It was something that had been reused from centuries before, and it was the writing that was on the reverse of it that was actually the thing that was of value. Well, I think we'll leave that there for today, Max. So thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.